This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Here in Chattanooga, Landrace Bioscience is a CBD startup that manufactures high-quality hemp extracts. This fall, it received the Spirit of Innovation Award from the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce. James Dawson is Landrace's Vice President for Sales and Marketing. James, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Your company has received quite a recognition recently here in Chattanooga.
We were absolutely thrilled to be considered as a Spirit of Innovation finalist and then to win the award. It meant a lot. We were finalists last year and had been through the process. So to see that we had continued to innovate and even done it to a level where we could win something like that, I think it was cool to see just a year over year on that.
A lot has changed in the past year, not only with the pandemic, but also with the business that Landrace is in.
It's changed substantially. The landscape for hemp and cannabis is continually shifting sands. The regulatory guidelines from the FDA, guidance from the DEA, because it's a nascent industry, the structural foundation is being formed. It's building an airplane after it's off a cliff in a way. As an industry, that's caused everyone who is a part of this industry to have to maintain a very high level of agility with their go-to-market strategy and revenue streams.
So what has Landrace had to do in the past year?
We initially launched as a company to serve comprehensively from, there's multiple steps of the supply chain, and we were going to occupy extracting, processing, post-processing, ingredient manufacturing, product development, white labeling products. And what we quickly realized is our value would be best fit for our industry to be very deep and narrow at what we are very good at. And so what we've moved towards is serving farms and serving other processors as a toll processing facility for their distillate oils. So we're doing distillation. And then also it's the science. So we were honored for this award based off of our patent pending cannabinoid delivery system. That is something that I think has really set us apart. It's enabled us to license our intellectual property to brands to enhance their products. And then on the distillation side, to be able to, you know, serve the Southeastern Economic Region as a manufacturing facility for them.
Tell us more about that delivery system and how it is key to your company's focus on the supply chain for your industry here within Tennessee and the Southeast.
A lot of people, at least I did, I knew it when I was a kid growing up out in the woods, white willow bark, it's got aspirin in it, right? You chew some white willow bark, it'll take your headache away. We all know now you can go to the pharmacy and you can get a liquid gel cap, fast absorbing, all this. There's a big jump between tree bark and a pharmaceutical drug. Our industry is not too dissimilar. You've got this plant and there are crude methods to consume this plant or use this plant. And what we've designed is a delivery system that allows the body to fully absorb it. So it's an oil-based extract and we're made of water. And so to try and ingest an oil, you're only going to actually absorb a small percent of it, 15, maybe even 20% of the oil you use, and the rest will just be excess. The delivery system that we designed allows the body to absorb it because it creates a soluble solution and also a permeable solution for topical use. So it's about taking an ingredient and making it more efficacious and speeding up delivery and onset.
And then another thing that you've had to adjust to in the past year is the changing number of hemp farmers. A lot of people went all in, and this is of course before the pandemic, a lot of people went all in and a bunch of those people found out it's not as easy as they thought it was going to be.
No, this was a classic gold rush scenario. Everybody's thinking, man, just got to get out there with my pickaxe. Part of our thought in the process was, hey, let's sell the pickaxes. Let's provide something that'll help all these people, and the ones that can make it will. But what you've just said is so true and really tragic in some cases. I mean, we've seen companies with hundreds of millions of dollars pumped into them that have fallen flat. We've seen families that have invested and taken loans out to grow crops, and crops have gone bad. And it's been tumultuous for everyone involved. And all of that, I believe, is because the regulatory landscape doesn't allow for sufficient supply chain. And so if you're going to, for instance, grow, who's buying it, right? And if you're going to be the person buying it to make ingredients, who's going to manufacture it into products? And if you're going to be a brand needing a full supply chain consolidated, who do you go? Who do you call? And the reason that this has been so difficult for so many companies is because we don't have that regulatory guidance that says you can make X or Y product. Right now, all the big brands are waiting to launch anything. Coke's not doing anything. They are, but they're not publicly doing anything. And all of these brands are kind of waiting in the wing for a green light, which means everybody who wanted to be first is having to tread water until some of these things get cleared up so that they can hit the gas.
In the meantime, the demand for CBD has only soared, and a lot of that is in response to the pandemic.
Yeah, we talked about it. It was actually the first ray of sunshine for me when I realized the industry we're in, just after the world shut down and no one knew what was going on or what was what, just to be able to say, wait a second, we are manufacturing a product that helps with promoting calm and promoting relaxation, and everyone is stressed. And so from that standpoint, business has been good because this is something that is in high demand.
And then what's the next horizon as we head into 2021?
The truth is, for our industry, the speed of when things will happen, I think, is going to be predicated by what recreational or medicinal marijuana laws are. The biggest hiccups, or I guess obstacles and challenges in our industry, is maintaining a certain THC threshold in our products. You know, and this is when I talk about the FDA or DEA guidance on this, and why they're just kind of limited. When you're manufacturing a concentrate that's going to go into and be diluted, there's a form of concentrate that technically doesn't apply to guidance, because the guidance just isn't there for pieces of the supply chain, because it wasn't thought through ahead of time. There's going to be a huge time difference for when that will be for our industry to really take off. I think the one thing you're going to want to look for is ingestibles. So right now, beverages, according to the FDA, are technically not allowed. Now, you wouldn't know that because you can go buy them. They're not doing anything about it. They're only writing warning letters to folks that are making false claims. This cures this or cures that without any scientific proof. You absolutely can't do that. But as far as the landscape really taking off and growing, I would say that the CBD industry will continue to grow into 2021. And I think as we see recreational marijuana or medicinal cannabis come online, all that's going to do is make what we do in hemp that much easier, because we won't have to work within a rigid framework that's pretend THC doesn't exist, because it's a molecule that's present in very, very small amounts in legal hemp. And we as processors need to be cognizant of that.
And where can people go online for more information about Landrace?
They would go to Landrace, Landrace, bio.com.
All right, James, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Red wolves are apex predators, critical to ecological balance. Without them, the rest of us, humans, other animals, and plants, cannot succeed. Red wolves are endangered, only 7 known in the wild, and 250 under human care. Here in Chattanooga, Mark McKnight is president and CEO of Reflection Riding Arboretum and Nature Center, and Tish Gailmard is director of wildlife there.
Mark, Tish, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us back.
And since we last talked, you have had a few additions there at Reflection Riding. Tell us more about that.
Yes, we have. We've added 2 red wolves to our pack that we have here, loosely called a pack. And we jokingly say that's brought us back to our 6 pack of red wolves. We brought in a new female and a new male. And this is all part of the Red Wolf Species Survival Plan. We're one of 42 cooperators in the world that work with red wolves. We breed, exhibit, and educate about red wolves, which is the most endangered canid in the world.
How much of this project has a presence in the Southeast beyond Reflection Riding?
We do have other cooperators in the Southeast, and that is purposeful because this is a native species to the Southeastern United States. So it's purposeful that we do have other cooperators in the area.
And of course, Mark, this has been a long time in coming.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been a part of this program really from early days and then have been a breeding partner as well. There are some facilities that have red wolves, but they're not actually participating in the breeding program as well. It's really fascinating to watch. One of the things that we always kind of struggle with, a species like this, this commitment to trying to recover the species and get it back out on the landscape and off of the endangered species list, this is not going to be the kind of thing that we're going to wrap up in a couple of years. This is a multi-generational commitment that we're making to try to save this animal from extinction. But the fun part of it is it is different every year, even though it's a long-term thing. And so we have two new wolves that are here, and it's just fun to see the different personalities. And Tish can tell you about the two wolves that came in, but one of them is just striking. You know, we call them the American red wolf, but this particular wolf is white. He is a ghost wolf. It's really fascinating. It's not a color that I've ever seen in the red wolf population. Mm-hmm. But it is. It's kind of fun to have new wolves again.
And then tell us more about the process as they grow.
Mm-hmm. The whole process is really cool. I think anybody would find it fascinating. We actually engineer who breeds with whom because we're dealing with a very small gene pool of only 14 founding parents. And so all red wolves that exist today came from those 14. So when you're dealing with a small gene pool and you need to be sure that your genes are diversified, we have to be extremely careful about who we breed with whom. So we actually have a geneticist that works with us and then a software program. Through those two things, that helps us keep our genetic diversity very strong. We're running at about 89% genetic diversity right now. And for a closed population, that is exceptionally good. So what we do is figure out if we need a particular wolf to breed based on mean kinship to the existing population. In layman's terms, if that wolf's genes are underrepresented in the current population, then we know we need that wolf to breed. But then we've got to find a wolf who is also underrepresented in the current population. And that's where our software program, our geneticists really point us in the right direction. So we find a male and a female we want to breed. And for instance, our female that we got just recently, she came from South Salem, New York. So there's logistics involved in this too. You have to figure out how to get that wolf to each facility. We do not fly them commercially. We can fly them on small private planes and we drive them. We typically drive wolves from facility to facility and we usually meet halfway. This time, Marley, our new red wolf, got a ride on a private plane from a nonprofit organization called Pilots to the Rescue. And then I picked her up in Virginia and drove her the rest of the way here. So she really, really got a nice ride.
She's a fancy wolf, flying private.
Yep.
I don't think she had any champagne or anything. She was pretty freaked out when she got here.
She's very freaked out still. She came from a facility, Wolf Conservation Center, and they are not open to the public, and they have very large enclosures, acre-plus enclosures, and she's only 2 years old. She's never been away from her parents, and she's never been away from her siblings. She does not know people voices because she's lived out in the middle of the woods at a facility that doesn't have visitors. So this is a very big transition in her life. It's going to be slow going for her to acclimate, but the goal is for her to breed with Colbert, one of our existing males, who is the most genetically valuable red wolf under human care. We need him to breed. So hopefully once she settles down, then things will happen well.
How are you handling things differently because of the pandemic?
One of the things that's obviously very different is that we no longer have a couple hundred school kids getting off of buses every morning to come see the wolves. So we are trying to engage digitally and be present for people, knowing that a lot of people are at home and looking for things, educational opportunities for their kids. And they want to see the wolves and see some of the other animal ambassadors that we have. Tish actually goes live once a week on Facebook, and we're moving that to Instagram. We have a dual feed now where we're holding two cell phones up at the same time to try to get that out to more people on Instagram. And then, you know, in terms of the logistics, we were just talking about transfer. The transfer has become much more of a hands-off where We kind of show up, drop the crate, let the other person pick it up, where we would have probably spent more time getting to know the other person and hanging out a little bit in the past.
It's a quick transfer. And of course, we're all masked up and it's very quiet out here. So we have a lot of visitorship from our members and our non-members, but they are walking on part of the property where the wolves aren't. So they're really just seeing two of us on a daily basis. And during breeding season, that's really ideal. We need it to be quiet and calm during breeding season. So in a way, it's a good thing happening over here. The male that we brought in, also, he's from a facility in Albany, Georgia, and he is an older male, and Mark referred to his coloration. He is really unusual. I can't wait for the public to see him eventually. He's so unusually marked. And I actually have spoken to other facilities that had him prior to us, and when he was a younger wolf, he was colored very typical of a red wolf. And as he's aged, he has gotten whiter than any old red wolf I have ever seen. He's beautiful, but he's very unusual. And he is an older wolf. He will be 13 in the spring. And we brought him in to be a companion with our soon-to-be 11-year-old female Sequoia. And they're getting along beautifully. I was watching them this morning cruising the enclosure together.
Once we do reopen, which we hope to be able to do safely, you know, as soon as possible, but certainly in the spring when we can let at least small groups back in, it will be fun for people to be able to see them, because you can't guarantee that somebody's going to see a wolf in an enclosure, because these are fairly large enclosures and they could be off in the back snoozing, especially during the summertime. They're kind of hiding, but these wolves are visible pretty much every time that I've been in there. So I think they'll be really good for the display.
Right, right. And then I don't want to cheat us out. We do have a second breeding pair also. Ruby and Apollo, who have been with us for several years now, they're going to breed again this year. So we have the potential for two litters in the spring. Breeding season is January, February, March, typical February in Chattanooga. And then it's a 63-day gestation. So puppies will land in April or May.
And then where can people go online to keep up to date with everything happening at Reflection Riding, wolves included?
Yeah, I always tell people, you want to be on our email list. That's the best way to stay in touch with all the many things that we have going on. So you can go to reflectionriding.org/news. And it's riding like riding a bike.
All right. Mark, Tish, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
The Jewish Festival of Hanukkah begins next week. Tomorrow night, starting at 6 p.m., Rabbi Craig Lewis of Mitzvah Congregation here in Chattanooga will teach a virtual class about it through the Chattery, titled History Happy Hour, The History and Mystery of Hanukkah.
Rabbi, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
You are going to share and explore in this online event about a holiday that, as you put it, it's not in the Jewish Bible, and it is considered a minor holiday in the Jewish faith, and yet we pay a lot of attention to it here. We have for generations.
Yeah, it's a holiday that gets a lot of extra attention because it falls in December, and for obvious reasons, there is opportunity, but also conflict that comes up with it. The opportunity is to sort of draw in some of the beauty of the lights and the gift giving and the good cheer and the goodwill that's surrounding us. But the conflict is the more that we do that, the less that we lose the true meaning of the holiday. And it is a holiday that's founded in light and good cheer and all of those things. But at its foundation is something very different than what Christmas is. So the class is partly going to explore what those differences are, how Hanukkah came to be, talk about maybe why it's considered a minor holiday, and how it's perhaps in American Judaism become perhaps the most major holiday.
And right down to why there are multiple spellings for the name.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that too. That's sort of, I'll do my sort of Hebrew grammar nerd out for that moment, where I get to explain why the ch has, you know, three different ways of representing it, why some people put one K, some people put two. And then after people wake up, I will go on to the next piece of it.
You are from the Midwest, from Kansas City. Tell us some of your earliest memories of this holiday.
So I grew up in a Reform Jewish home. My mother of blessed memory was always involved, not just in making Hanukkah important in our home, but also in the community at large. And she was the director of the Hebrew school that I went to. So it was always about how to teach it, how to program for it, then bringing some of those things home. And it was always important to gather around, light candles, have the candles appear in the window of our home. No matter what, there should always be at least a present every night, which is something that's one of those things that sort of grew over time as part of American Judaism to accommodate the falling around Christmas time. So, well, how do you teach kids to love Hanukkah? Say, well, instead of just one day of presents, as Adam Sandler puts it, you get eight crazy nights. So it was always something that was a focal point of the year. And there was always, you know, my mom would make latkes, and we'd have one night where we'd get together with all of our extended family and cousins and make a big deal out of it. So, you know, my earliest memories were saying the blessings around the menorah, or the Chanukiah, which is the technical term for it, eating the Hanukkah food and singing the songs.
And how would you say celebrations have varied from place to place where you have lived over the years?
Well, weather has definitely played a role in it. You know, when I grew up in Kansas City, it was always cold, and so everything had to be indoors. There was some time that I spent in California, and you could actually celebrate Hanukkah on the beach if you wanted to. This wasn't really geographically limited, but I do remember once having tickets to see a Mighty Ducks game in Anaheim, and we actually had access to a suite, so we lit candles in the suite, which was kind of fun. It was a once-in-a-lifetime. And we did get some strange looks from other people, but we didn't care. It was fine. That's what Hanukkah is all about.
And this is steeped in history. This is about miracles. You're still formulating this class as we speak, and we don't want to give everything away, but just a little bit.
Yeah, the chatter would be upset with me. If I taught the whole class right now, they'd, you know, be really upset, and I don't want to do that. They're very nice folks. Yeah, the historical aspect of it is a military battle. It was a revolt against the Seleucid Empire that were trying to Hellenize the nations around them that they were occupying. And, you know, a group of zealous Israelites that were from the priestly caste, that was the Maccabee family, started a revolt and overwhelmed the invaders. And then they rededicated the temple. And that's what Hanukkah means, is dedication. And so it's about the rededication of the temple once they drove out the pagan empire that had, you know, erected a statue of Zeus there and desecrated the temple. And so it's about rededication.
Given the year that we have had in so many ways, what lessons might this Hanukkah coming up share for us?
It's a really great question. I think that if I had to just take a stab at it from a health perspective, it's a holiday that talks about hope, that you always can look forward to a brighter tomorrow. And that's actually a Talmudic teaching. Now, I'd probably bring this into the class now that I'm thinking about it, is that there was a debate. You have, you know, eight candles and you light one each night. And they debated, do you start with eight and count down from 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or do you go one and all the way up? And they ultimately decided that you're only supposed to add light to the world, not diminish light from the world. And as we hope to see an emergence from this pandemic in the future, we seek to enhance light and hope as we move forward. Without exposing any sides, I think from a political outlook too, that's another way to look at it, is to say, here we are. The best way to approach this is from a perspective of adding light and illumination to the world, and we should stop chiseling away and detracting from it.
And proceeds from this event will help spread light. Tell us more about that.
The proceeds will go to the Rabbi's Discretionary Fund at Mitzvah Congregation, and those funds are used to support members of my community if they're in need of financial support. It does also go to sort of educational or camp scholarships for families who might need some support. It goes towards sometimes just basic utilities for people if there's a struggle. I also can support nonprofits like the food bank in the area. So it's a fund that only goes to support nonprofit causes and to try and make people's lives better.
And if people want more information about this online course, they can check it out and they can sign up at thechattery.org. For more information about your congregation, where can they go online?
So we are mitzvahcongregation.org, online. We also have a Facebook presence, so you can also check us out on Facebook, Mitzvah Congregation, and like us and get in touch with upcoming events. And occasionally I'll post my sermons on a blog, and you can check those out as well. We were on Instagram, but not for a little bit, so hopefully we will be again soon.
All right. Rabbi, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And I look forward to seeing, having as many people as we can in the class and listening to your show. So thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon, we have the first part of a beautiful two-part recital live in Barking Legs featuring the gifted guitar player, Alan Chicot.
Well, good evening. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for your support of this wonderful Wednesday Night Jazz series here at Barking Legs Theater. I got a fresh new hour set for you, those of you that tuned in last time, as we'll see what happens. I'd like to continue with a couple arrangements by my all-time favorite musician, my guitar idol, and the player who got me started in terms of capturing my imagination and making me feel like this is something that I wanted to do seriously, and that would be the French guitarist Roland Dienz. First tune that he's arranged is a wonderful French jazz tune from the 60s, kind of cool jazz type period. This is from a singer named Claude Nougaro from France. This is called Cécile Ma Fille, or My Daughter Cécile. Thank you. course, the classic Misty, arranged by Roland Dienz. Quick funny story about Roland and those jazz arrangements. The CD of which that Misty was included, the CD is called Night and Day, the tune. 10 tunes on it, published sheet music for all the arrangements. And when it first came out, I must have been a junior in high school, I think. Was in the car with my first teacher, and I said, have you heard the new Dienz CD yet? He said, no, I haven't heard it yet. We popped it in and listened to it. The first track, I remember, was All of Me. You know, I was just basically completely incredulous that this kind of guitar playing was even possible. What I was hearing just sounded completely impossible. And my teacher was sort of proverbially patting me on the head and saying, well, I think this might be a duet, you know, with himself, like it's overdubbed or something in the studio. That would have been something that Roland would have done. I said, no, I'm pretty sure it's solo guitar. It's supposed to be for solo guitar. A few months later, the sheet music came out. Of course, I could see it for myself. Couldn't play a note of it, but listen along with the CD and follow along with the score. It'd be many years later before I would even attempt one of those arrangements, and it still kicks my butt, as you can hear. But serendipitously, that year, Roland Dienz came to the Stetson International Guitar Workshop, took a little group down there to the workshop in Florida, hear Roland play, and of course, he played several of the jazz arrangements, including that Misty that I just played. I still have a recording of it, which is near and dear to me since Roland has passed away. I got to see it for myself, and yes, it was possible, and Roland played it much better than I do, so it's encouraging. It's discouraging and encouraging at the same time. It's one of those things that you see in person that makes you want to quit playing, and then you come home and think about it some more, and makes you want to keep practicing. Pardon the tuning. The lights get hot up here. It's not good for nylon strings. All right. I'd like to continue with some Brazilian music. Actually, the last time I played here, we were hanging out chatting afterwards, and Bruce mentioned a Brazilian guitarist named Baden Powell, fantastic player. And there's some wonderful videos like from the 50s and 60s, old black and white stuff. I'll never forget seeing Baden Powell play Around Midnight, the Thelonious Monk tune. Gave an amazing solo guitar performance of it. You can watch on YouTube, and he's holding a lit cigarette in between his fingers while playing very fast passages with the right hand. It's like, it's pretty cool. I don't know if it makes me want to smoke cigarettes, but it's pretty cool. So Baden Powell was an amazing player, very prolific composer, too, a lot of people don't realize, wrote probably 200, 300 tunes that I've seen floating around. So I'm going to start with one of his tunes called Samba em Preludio, and I'm going to follow that with my own arrangement of Menage Carnival, a tune that's the theme from the movie Black Orpheus. Some people just refer to the tune as Black Orpheus. You may recognize the melody, but the title is Menage Carnival, Morning of Carnival. Samba em Preludio followed by Menage Carnival. Thank you. Good tune, Ménage du Carnaval. Louis Bonnefoy, the composer of that tune, and a lot of musicians know Bonnefoy, the writer of that tune, and also a tune called Orpheus Samba from the same movie, Black Orpheus. Many people, almost no one knows that Bonnefoy actually was a phenomenal guitar player, top-notch solo guitar player, better than the rest of the Brazilian players of his generation that helped import the bossa nova, as I mentioned earlier, Lourenço Almeida, Baden Powell. I mean, I'm not saying those are not great players, of course, and their work speaks for itself, but Louis Bonnefoy was a solo guitarist of the highest order. There's a recording called Solo in Rio 1959, a wonderful recording you can probably find on Spotify or YouTube. He did things back then that I've still not heard anybody do on one of his instruments. Amazing walk bass and chords at the same time in just a very, very peculiar and sort of personal way. I've just not heard anybody be able to emulate his sound. Wonderful player, Louis Bonnefoy. I'd like to stay in Brazil for a little while longer. Last time I played here, I did kind of a little feature of the music of a very famous Brazilian composer that almost no one knows by name. He went by the nickname Garoto. I'd like to do a similar kind of thing this time, but with a Brazilian composer that I hope you recognize the name of, or at least recognize some of his music, and that is Antonio Carlos Jobim. Wrote many, many, many famous bossa nova tunes, but I think, unfortunately, a lot of his best music, in my opinion, is hardly played, at least at jazz gigs. He wrote a lot of more, we would say, through-composed music, quasi-classical compositions. He sang and accompanied himself on the piano and the guitar, sometimes with orchestra, but just a phenomenal musician, prolific songwriter and composer. So I'd like to play a medley, maybe 12, maybe 15 minutes or so medley of his music, and hopefully I won't have to stop and tune along the way, but these lights are really killing my nylon strings here, but if you can bear with me, I'll try to make it to the end of the medley. So you're going to hear some tunes that you recognize, one-note samba, wave, how insensitive, but there's also going to be interspersed in there some tunes that you probably won't recognize as Antonio Carlos Jobim. As I said, more quasi-classical, very introspective, some of the most emotive music I've heard on record recently, so I would encourage all of you to check out the recordings of Antonio Carlos Jobim. So I hope you hear some things that you like in this medley. I'll see you at the end. I'm going to start with his one-note samba. Thank you.
Every Wednesday evening, Barking Legs hosts a virtual jazz show on their Wednesday Night Jazz Facebook page. The Alan Wyatt Quartet is the featured act tomorrow evening, Wednesday, at 8 o'clock. Next week, we'll have the second half of this beautiful recital by guitarist Alan Chicot here on Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.